WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello, and welcome to WrestleSpective Radio at fairtoflare.com. I'm Jason Mann, and with me for the very first time is Joe Drilling, and he is a contributor to the On the Stick bi-weekly video game podcast, also has written for the Fair to Flare Quarterly, and does many other things.
That's
Joe,
right.
How you doing today?
I'm great. Doing good.
Good. Good to hear. So we are going to talk about the main event of SummerSlam 2000, which is The Rock defending the WWE Championship against Triple H and Kurt Angle in a three-way match. The second year in a row, SummerSlam was headlined by a three-way match. And sort of interesting in that The Rock's really not even, I mean, he's a major part of the match, but he's not really a major part of the story. Really, the focus is on Triple H and Kurt Angle sort of being involved in a love triangle with Stephanie McMahon, which at this point had really kind of hit an interesting note. It was kind of a different story than they had been telling, you know, really quite memorable and really seemed to be building toward Triple H becoming kind of a badass good guy and Stephanie turning on him and joining up with Kurt, and then Triple H, of course, eventually getting his revenge. It just seemed like all the pieces were in place for that, and then of course it turned out very differently, which we can talk about toward the end. So in 2000, where were you as far as your wrestling fandom?
So when this pay-per-view aired, this is an interesting one for me because this is, I was 17. I was about to start my senior year in high school. And this is also my last SummerSlam purely as a wrestling fan, because I would eventually go on to train in the ring and become a professional wrestler on the indie circuit. And my training started in the spring of 2001.
Oh, wow.
So this was my last SummerSlam as just, you know, straight up just totally marking out and loving every second of it and really being invested, not so much in how are they doing what they're doing, but just like, yeah, go Triple H and, or, you know, whatever, which is probably my tack at the time, although it's difficult to remember. But I was a big Triple H fan and continue to be to this day for, you know, forever. So I was probably rooting for Triple H, but, okay. You know, I was just totally in love with the product and just totally a full on fan, having people over to my house, you know, for pay-per-views and, you know, trading off with friends of who's going to order somebody would order the WCW pay-per-view. And then usually I would order the WWF pay-per-view and then somebody else would order the ECW pay-per-view. And, you know, so I was really just in the thick of it in high school. It was summer vacation. I was, you know, that's where I was, you know, in terms of my fandom at that point. So.
Yeah, and 2000 was just a really strong year, particularly the first half or so, two-thirds even, of 2000 was just a really – like, WWE basically delivered on every pay-per-view. You know, like, the storytelling was really good. Like, they just had a bunch – they had a really deep roster. They brought over Jericho, Benoit, Malenko, Saturn, Eddie Guerrero – and Kurt Angle was an addition, all had, you know, debuted in late 99 or early 2000. So they really just had a lot of depth there. They'd create a lot of characters who had gotten over really big. Rikishi, for instance, and Too Cool, who are part of this show.
Yep.
Just really, you know, clicking on all cylinders. Taz was there, and he was kind of hot as a heel at this point. So really a, you know, strong up and down up and down show. And, so it was definitely a fun year, and it would sort of start to come unraveled a little bit toward the end of 2000 and into 2001, although they still had some really strong shows and some good stuff, and you know they were doing fine, but there were kind of some hints that the glory days weren't going to last forever. But
yeah, well, I mean, in terms of, I think, of the popularity, if memory serves, it was, you know, the really hot period was, you know, 97, 98, 99, and it was starting to cool down a little bit at this point, especially since Austin was already out with his neck injury by this point.
Yeah.
And, you know, WCW was not doing a lot of really great things at this point. But interestingly, I mean, from the perspective of the in-ring product, 99 was a really hot year for wrestling and for the sensationalism, and it sort of hit the fever peak of the Jerry Springer-esque, you know, stuff.
Yeah, the Crash TV kind of, the shock and stuff, yeah. Sure.
But there was not a lot of wrestling, and even though the product wasn't quite as popular in 2000, it had been in 98, 99, I think the actual wrestling was a lot better, you know,
yeah.
And I think this main event really shows that off in terms of storytelling in the ring, having a good long main event, and really having a good story going into it. And really going into it, I think it establishes a really great dynamic for a triple threat match, which I think is important. And when you talk about a triple threat match, you know, the best way to do it is generally considered to be two heels and a babyface. Mm-hmm. Two baby faces and a heel kind of doesn't really work, because then you split the crowd between the two baby faces. But this works really great because Triple H essentially plays both roles depending on what point in the match we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because everybody understands why he's upset at Angle, because Angle, you know, kissed his wife on the SmackDown previous,
right,
and had been making a play for his wife before that. But everybody loves The Rock. So, you know, Triple H plays a really fantastic role as sort of in between kind of guy for this particular match, even though overall he was a heel, you know, at this time pretty well. But in this particular match, when he's fighting The Rock, he gets booed. And when he's fighting Angle, he gets cheered. And that works out really well as a great dynamic for a triple threat match.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, kind of heading into this, of course, Rock and Triple H had basically been feuding since WrestleMania time. They traded the title a couple of times. Rock won it, actually, strangely, pinning Vince McMahon in a six-man at King of the Ring 2000. That was kind of one of the few missteps they had during that time. Basically, the way the match is set up, there's a triple threat with Triple H, Angle, and Jericho. They end up with both pinning Jericho, so they both end up getting the title shot. And then we see Angle hitting on Stephanie McMahon, as you mentioned. Stephanie walks in on Triple H and Trish Stratus training a little bit, but in a compromising position with Steph wants her space a little bit, a little angry about kind of the situation. So Kurt's sort of there to be the emotional support. And so forth. And then, of course, that leads to a match where Kurt's accidentally thrown into Stephanie during a tag match. Triple H carries her to the back, then comes back and gets destroyed. And then we have Angle going back to help Stephanie. And that's the point where he kisses her. And she first sort of seems to resist, and then she seems to embrace it. So there's that little thread there, too. That was pretty cool detail, you know. Yeah, we start with Angle on the mic, who says he won't apologize, but he does apologize. He apologizes for not kissing her sooner, and says that he gave Stephanie the passion that Triple H couldn't. And basically, we have Triple H coming out and going after him right away before the match technically even started. And this probably goes like 4 minutes, where he basically just completely destroys him. Angle does take a little bit of control outside, but then Triple H tosses Angle outside really hard, throws him into the stairs, and slams him into the table. And then he tries the pedigree through the Spanish table, but it sort of collapses mid-move, and Angle knocks his head off the table and suffers a concussion. So
that was ugly. I mean, it was he essentially goes to, you know, Triple H basically goes to jump up for the pedigree, and when he pushes down, instead of him going up, the table goes down.
Right.
And I watched it back, and it actually looks like it looks like Angle's face misses the table completely and essentially goes straight to the floor.
Ah, I see.
Which is how it looked to me, and so that I think is probably a good indication of what caused that him to be pretty well out of it. And, you know, to hear it be told, apparently he was, you know, I mean,
yeah.
You know, he was out of it at this point. And at that point, you know, basically The Rock comes down. You wonder at that point if that's when The Rock was supposed to come down or if someone hit the panic button, you know. And you kind of wonder from here how much of this was what they had planned and how much of it was, oh boy, now we got to do something.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming they had to improvise a lot of it because, yeah, I mean, basically Angle is checked out for a few minutes, then stretchered out. Triple H goes after him for a bit, and then they mess about. Stephanie comes out and sort of helps Angle while he's on the stretcher to the back. So, but it's a lot of, I mean, 90% of the match is basically a Triple H Rock singles match, which, you know, they'd obviously had dozens of those, not, you know, just in, of course, in 2000, but in many before that too. I mean, they'd feuded in, you know, throughout 98 and 99, 97. So they had feuds all those years. So they'd obviously were familiar with each other and pulled off a really great match, you know, just despite having to do that in the fly. That's obviously, you know, a great credit to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, they, you know, I'm sure they were calling it in the ring and, you know, two guys like that, you would expect that calling it in the ring, they'll get the job done, you know, just as well as anybody else. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's the whole pre-match thing is very good because I feel like right now we don't get enough in-ring promos before main events, especially on pay-per-views, you know, which I think is, I feel like something we used to get a lot more in the 80s and the 90s. And, that's kind of gone. I mean, we still get in-ring promos, but not right before a match, not to heat up the crowd that way.
Yeah.
That Angle did. And then the whole thing, I mean, with Triple H comes in, I mean, like a house of fire, like, you know, like you would expect a good guy to normally do, which again is the role he's playing at that point. Cause this dude was, you know, messing around with his wife. So he gets in there and he just pummels him and the crowd's going nuts for that. And then when The Rock comes out, they go really nuts to watch The Rock beat up Triple H. You know, the one thing that I don't like, though, is we get to this point. So Angle's on his way out, Rock's on his way in, and Triple H pulls out the sledgehammer, and I hate the sledgehammer.
So does Jim Ross, by the way.
Yeah, you know, yeah, right. Get,
he get wants that the damn hammer. Sledgehammer out of the ring.
get rid of the damn hammer. And, you know, I mean, I've never, and again, as I said, I'm a lifelong Triple H fan, and I always have been a fan of his work, but the sledgehammer just drives me nuts. Because if you hit someone with a sledgehammer, that's it. It's over. My suspension of disbelief is really, really disrupted every time the sledgehammer comes into play. Because either you have to hit someone with it in a way that if you were actually going to hit someone with a sledgehammer, you would never hit them with it.
Yeah.
Or you have to pull it back and it looks really bad. Or, you know, it just nothing works with it. He hits him in the, eventually Triple H hits The Rock in the gut with the sledgehammer. And at that point, I'm like, you would burst his appendix. The match is over. Like, it's done. So I hate the sledgehammer in spite of, that's like the one thing about this match that I really don't care for is the hammer.
Yeah, I'm willing to sort of, I can suspend disbelief a little bit, but I definitely agree that the sledgehammer shots usually look pretty weak, you know, because obviously, yeah, if you hit somebody with it like it's meant to be hit, you would crush their head or crush them or whatever, you know, kind of like he does sort of the, like he, instead of swinging it, he'll just sort of hold it and slam it, like I said, sort of into the gut. That one I'll buy a little bit more, but obviously you're right, in real life that would, you know, kill him or you know, come close to it, so. We have Rock come out, and like I said, it's quite a long period of time where Triple H and Angle, like, you obviously normally Rock would just kind of come out right after Triple H comes out, but there's definitely that pause where they, you know, where they set that up, which is interesting. I think there's a couple of sort of slower parts where they're trying to kind of, I'm sure they're just kind of work things out as the EMTs are checking Angle and so forth, but they really do a good job of, you know, kind of covering for, you know, whatever they do. There's one point where you can tell that Triple H is asking the ref to check on Angle, but,
yep.
You know, So we have Triple H sort of taking control first. Rock charges in, gets the better Triple H with punches. So he drops the sledgehammer right away. That's not used till later. He hits the Samoan drop, slams him on the steps and so forth. Eventually, Triple H gets control, does some stomping, running reverse elbow. And at this point, Angle stretchered out. Then Rock makes a pretty good comeback, but then he's drops stomach first on the ropes and sort of flips over to the ropes. Kind of one of the bigger bumps I've ever seen him take.
Yeah, no doubt. And then there's lots of out of the ring action at that point. And
yeah,
that's the thing I noticed about this match. And a lot of matches from this time period, and we talk about that, you know, 97, 98, 99, 2000 time period. Tons and tons of outside the ring action. And it's done well in this case, so yeah. I don't mind it. I do think, and Ross keeps saying, he keeps reiterating, no DQs, no countouts, there will be a winner. You know, and so that's always fresh in our minds that, well, why aren't they getting counted out, or why aren't, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. I feel like at this time that was sort of, there was maybe too much of that outside the ring.
That was pretty much every main event at this point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't see that much today, so when you go back and look at it, I think it's a little more exciting than it was then, you know, to 2011 eyes, which is kind of cool. Because I've gone back to kind of the 99-2000 stuff, expecting it not to sort of be like, you know, sort of be dull like I remember it being. And it's like, oh, that's kind of actually more exciting than I remembered it being. So I think that's part of it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And again, in this match, I feel like it was well done.
Yes.
I haven't been watching a lot of stuff from this era lately. I've been watching a lot of just sort of in my leisure time. I've been watching a lot of early '90s stuff. Although I guess I've been watching that The Best of Nitro DVD. I've been kind of pushing my way through that. So I guess that's a lot of the similar area that we're seeing here. But yeah, I mean, I just remembered it. Like, it came back to me like a flood. Like, I was like, oh man, they used to do this all the time, you know. But I would agree with what we've been seeing lately, it was a little more exciting to see all this brawling outside of the ring. And again, it is well done. Interestingly, we see that in spite of the Rock's race, which he's, you know, half black and half Samoan, he can still manage to have tan lines during this outside the ring action. So,
yeah.
Because Triple H gives him a wedgie for some reason and then is going to do something and it kind of doesn't work out. But yeah, and they go all the way down the entranceway and they come all the way back and they go, you know, so.
Yeah, and Triple H goes after Angle on the stretcher and then brings it back to the ramp, sort of punches him in the head. Rock eventually comes out and goes after him. They brawl a bit on the stage. Then Rock reverses a pedigree and does a catapult onto some steel pipes that are sort of part of the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually Rock, he gets tossed in the railing, but he lands a clothesline, does his famous punch to the balls, which is always a fun, good guy move.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we have Stephanie come out to check on Angle, and then sort of they go back into the stretcher and gives the fans a chance to chant slut at Stephanie, which is also a fun. It's fun to see the stuff the PG era now WWE got away with during this time, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can't silence the fans, and I mean, I think they certainly, especially Chris Jericho and that, they really, you know, the wrestlers encouraged that at Stephanie.
Yeah, the fans were cued to do that. It wasn't like they did that on their own, you know. And they eventually did it on their own, but yeah, I mean, they were. That was the intention. So
right, and you know, Stephanie is actually. I've never been a huge Stephanie fan, but she's looking pretty cute here because she doesn't have giant fake boobs yet.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, which is nice.
She was also still very effective in her role at this point. Mm-hmm, she would kind of get really grating later and get really – and I would get really sick of her. But for, you know, 2000 into 2001, I think she was pretty effective. I mean, she was – you know, became an extraordinarily good performer fairly quick into, you know, from when she debuted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no.
Didn't take very long. I mean, she really got it. I don't think Shane ever really quite had that same. I mean, he was. I can see his strengths as a performer, even though I really don't like him. Just don't like the character and didn't like a lot of things he did. But she was more of a natural, I think, than he was.
Yeah. No. You see, and this is going to turn into a digression, but edit it out if you want.
Digressions are good.
So I actually was a big fan of Shane, and as an on-screen character, and I mean, I've heard that he's a very nice guy, so, but I don't know much about his, because he's now, you know, he's not been with the company for a number of years now, but
sure.
As an on-screen character, I was always a big fan of Shane McMahon. I always liked him, and on this show, I forgot what a stacked show this was, and I totally forgot that this was the giant Shane bump off the Titantron show,
yeah.
Where Steve Blackman climbs up after him and hits him with the cane, and he takes a swan dive off the thing. But Shane, I feel like, even though he wasn't a wrestler, he wrestled, but he wasn't a wrestler, you know what I mean? And he wasn't,
sure.
He wasn't in that role. I mean, there's never a point where he had a match with someone and you were like, oh man, Shane's going to give him a technical masterpiece and he's going to give this guy a run for his money. You're always like, either he's going to cheat or he's going to brawl or he's going to, you know, hit him in the head with stuff or whatever. But he, I mean, to get himself over and to get over whatever angle he was in and whatever guy he was working with, I mean, Shane really went to the mat, even in a way that I don't think Vince ever did. You know, Shane took that bump off the Tron, which, yeah, he fell into a pile of padding or whatever. But I'll tell you, man, I would be nervous to fall off that thing. And then, you know, at King of the Ring, I think it was 2001, Angle suplexed him through the glass and suplexed him one time through the glass, and he didn't go through the glass, and he lands on his head. And I mean, he took his licks to really get over the guys he was working with and get over the angle and try to sell the show. And you know, I
yeah.
liked his goofy shot, like running around and shuffling, and
yeah,
I'm Shane O'Mac, not... and I liked that. I thought it was funny.
Yeah,
it's just me though.
No. I'll counter. Point on that. Well, I will agree that he was willing to put his body on the line and do all those things, but he also set the bar really high for the wrestlers who had to do all the time, whereas he only had to do it, like, you know, very rarely.
That's true.
And I don't like the stunt aspects of wrestling very much. I think it's really taken the power away from the more basic things, the more basic, you know, storytelling in the ring. Like it became for a time, all wrestling fans seemed to want were big, huge, crazy stunts.
Yeah.
And it's not just Shane. There's a lot of guys who were part of it too. And guys who I really like, you know,
like Mick Foley.
Yeah. Mick Foley, for instance. Yeah. Who just set the bar so high and just like, I think Jim Cornette said it, where we had to, you know, do twice as much to get half the reaction, kind of, you know, kind of thing. So I just think that really hurt the wrestling for a long time, and really just made it so much harder to get fans to care about matches and certain things. So, you know, I agree those moments were certainly exciting, but I just think there's a huge negative thing too. And that's not really even why I don't particularly care for Shane as a performer. I just kind of think he's a little bit grating and so forth.
Sure.
But I definitely see your points. I mean, I don't think and Shane seems like a nice guy too. I'm sure he's a great person, but as a performer and as everything, I just kind of always cringe whenever I see him, even in the past. Although the angle match he did was pretty incredible. I will certainly grant that.
Yeah. Well, I would say, so in terms of Jim Cornette, I mean, so first of all, I love Jim Cornette, and I love his views on wrestling psychology, and I love his views on storytelling in matches. But also, I mean, this is coming from a guy who took a bump off a scaffold in 1984 or whatever.
That's 1986, true. 86,
yeah.
But yes.
86, yeah.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, he was setting the bar high already and broke his foot, I think, or something. Whatever.
I think he injured his knee. Severe knee injury for...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, so... He was part and parcel to that too, as much as he, you know.
That's a good point. Well, I mean, yeah, he probably would agree with that too. But it's more just, you know, I do think that there. I'm glad that in the last few years, particularly WWE, has toned a lot of that stuff down. I mean, they still have the crazy ladder matches, and they still have kind of crazy stuff. They don't do the chair shots to the head and stuff. And it's like they've at least sort of lessened the expectations a bit and kind of toned it down and kind of made it more. I don't know, safer, and I think that long term will pay off.
Yeah, I think that at any era you can probably find a match that is mostly contained to the ring and is good storytelling and gets over, you know, with the crowd regardless of what else is happening around it. And I'm trying to think of a good example from this era, or from this, even from this card. I mean, like, for example, I take the opening match of this card, which was a 6-man tag match, which, oh my goodness, tag team, two tag teams with names, not just two guys thrown together, having a match on a pay-per-view.
Yeah.
On a WWE show, if you can believe that. But, you know, it was a different era. So there's no, I mean, there's butts and faces, I guess. But, like, really, there's no, it gets over big time with the crowd. Rikishi and Too Cool were over huge. Right to Censor is over huge as heels. And there's no jumping off of high things and no exploding tables and no chair shots and no, and it still gets over, you know, pretty well. So I sure. think, you know, there's always a place for storytelling, you know, and that will always, I mean, look at last weekend, you know, it was, or I guess 2 weekends ago now, you know, it was one of the hottest matches in recent memory and probably the last several years, just a straight up match between two guys. And apparently, you know, from what I'm seeing, people loved it, you know, besides us, you know,
yeah.
So
you're talking about CM Punk and John Cena for people who listen to this like in a year and don't know who we're referring to. Yes. Money in the Bank. But I definitely see your points and interesting point of view. I still think it's good to save that stuff for like really, really special occasions. And, you know, I guess I don't know if Shane McMahon and Steve Blackman exactly qualifies, but I, certainly he did some memorable things and, you know, and that's kind of creating memorable moments is definitely part of what wrestling is too. So I can see that.
I think the hardcore title is one of the worst ideas anybody's ever had, for the record. The hardcore title was a terrible, terrible idea.
Yes.
And, never should have been done. So I'll put that as a little caveat at the end there.
Okay.
I think that was awful. So,
yeah. One thing I will say about this whole card is like, it kind of shows the strength of the 2000s period is they had a lot of variety when it came to like different sorts of like styles and acts. I mean, as much variety as WWE ever has, which they're always kind of been a little bit vanilla in their style of wrestling, you know, very much limiting the moves, kind of having the very distinct psychology and so forth, and not really importing a lot of international talent, that kind of thing. But but they did really have some acts that were kind of different from each other. I mean, Rikishi was obviously, you know, kind of was a neat character. They did have some. I mean, you had like Benoit and Jericho having a really good classic 2 out of 3 falls match, although it was a little short. It was only 13 minutes to do three falls. But they had a good rivalry and had some really fun matches during that time. And you had a good kind of a really neat Lawler Taz feud where, you know, Taz had kind of gone after Jim Ross, then Lawler defends him. And this was kind of Lawler's first, like, I mean, he'd sort of slid over to kind of be the good guy commentator a little bit as far as, I mean, he kind of had the edge, but he was, it was clear that he and Ross were friends and so forth. But this was really the first time he'd actually defended Ross and really was, you know, kind of a straight up good guy character in WWE. And, you know, a lot of fun things as well. So, and of course the TLC match, the first TLC match, Edge and Christian, Hardy Boys and Dudley Boys, you know, kind of a lot of stunts and crazy stuff as well, but also, you know, really exciting and kind of a high point for this era's tag division. You know, I think 2000, they really did have a strong tag division.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, yeah, they definitely did. And I think they sort of continued to eventually sort of coming off of this. I think eventually what happened is the tag division just became the Hardy Boys, the Dudley Boys, and Edge and Christian.
Right.
For a couple of years there, which I was kind of, you know, a little less of that kind of got stale eventually.
Yes.
And then it turned into like every 3 months there was another TLC match or something similar. But I think it's a credit to this show and to the storytelling of all the guys involved that really I didn't feel worn out by the show by the time I got to the end of it. Because, I mean, you're talking about, you've got Steve Blackman versus Shane McMahon. You've got the first ever TLC match. You've got, you know, and you've got this main event that has, you know, that's a no holds barred match. And each one does enough things differently that you don't feel like you're worn out or you're seeing the same thing over and over again. Or, because I don't know about you, but I did watch the entire show. And I didn't feel like the main event suffered because Shane McMahon fell off the Titantron, or the main event suffered because, you know, Jeff Hardy jumped through a table, or, you know, any of that. I didn't feel Like, I felt like each of these three big, you know, stunt-laden, hitting guys in the head with stuff style matches were different enough from each other that they all worked on their own.
Okay.
That's my opinion. So, okay. I mean, I think it's credit to all 9-11 of those guys that were involved in all those matches.
Yeah.
You know, that they were all able to do that and keep it that way. And I felt like, you know, again, this main event felt like it should have been the main event and felt like a big deal and like it was done right and told a satisfying story, even though, you know, at the end we see, you know, as viewers, especially in a vacuum, you know, if you watch the DVD, you're like, okay, well, Kurt Angle ran off with Stephanie and now I don't know what happens. So,
yeah,
you know, but generally speaking, I think it's a very satisfying story that's told in the main event and is a great main event. And I think one of the really great things about the main event as well, trying to sort of kind of get us a little back on topic, is again, going back to Triple H and his sort of role here. And when you watch Triple H in this match, depending on who he is fighting at the time, he's fighting differently. When he's fighting Kurt Angle, he's fighting Kurt Angle to hurt Kurt Angle. Mm-hmm. When he's fighting The Rock, he's fighting The Rock to win the WWE title.
Yeah.
And I think that's important from a psychology standpoint, because with, you know, there's even a point at the beginning where JR says it's not about, because Kurt Angle was King of the Ring that year, and it's not about kings or titles. And I was like, well, it kind of is, because it's a title match, but with Kurt Angle, it really isn't. You know, I don't even, and I guess I'd have to watch it again, but I'm trying to remember, and I don't think Triple H, maybe one time he tries to pin Kurt Angle, but it's always about beating up Kurt Angle.
Right.
And trying to win against The Rock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a good point. You know, and I don't know if that would have necessarily been the case if Angle hadn't missed most of the match because of the injury. But I mean, it worked out very well, and that definitely makes a lot of sense. That's a good observation, I think. We kind of after you know, the stretcher goes to the back, we have you know, Rock and Triple H get into it more. Steph actually kind of comes back out, and Triple H tells her that she's not supposed to be there, but then he tells her to get the belt, and she comes in and swings the belt, but ends up hitting Triple H instead, which only gets two. Then Rock lifts Stephanie by the hair as she's trying to get away, and then Triple H gets the low blow and then sends her out. So we got a little cameo there. And then we just kind of get some back and forth action. Rock hits a flying clothesline. Triple H gets his neck breaker. And then finally, Triple H gets the hammer and nails him in the ribs, and then kind of spends a lot of time going after the ribs, does some shoulder thrusts into his torso. And Rock kind of has some hope spots, but you know, Triple H is there to cut him off. Hits a face buster for two, does some knees to the back. Picks him up outside and back first to the post and so forth.
Yeah, I think all that's really good stuff too, because he's, you know, again, showing Triple H's capability as a storyteller. You know, he hits him in the gut with a sledgehammer, and then it's all about that whole midsection, even going to the back, you know, to sort of work that whole area, keep the ribs soft, keep him, you know, clutching his gut and all that. And I'm sorry, I just had to chime in on the Stephanie thing since we went past that.
Of course.
Stephanie comes out, Triple H tells her to get the belt. She walks over and slaps Mark Yeaton for no reason.
That's right.
And then she proceeds to deliver the worst looking belt shot in the history of professional wrestling.
Oh, like, I mean, it wasn't good, but I don't know if I go that far. But
like, oh, it was really like, she's like hesitant, and then like, she holds there just long enough to make sure that Rock ducks out of the way. And then she kind of love taps Triple H in the head, and he takes this huge bump off it and sells it, you know, like he just got hit by a freight train, which is good on him, but it just looked, oh man, as Jim Ross might say, it looked bowling shoe ugly from where I was sitting. And but the slap on Mark Eaton is the funniest thing. He just walks over,
yeah,
and the belt's on the timekeeper's table, and he doesn't even try to stop her from taking it. She just walks up and slaps him, and then she grabs it and runs into the ring.
You know, she's a McMahon. She could fire him. So
that's true.
You know,
that's true.
He's not gonna resist too much. So yeah, you're right. That was very amusing. Mm-hmm. Let's see. So eventually, yeah, Triple H cuts him off with the knee to the abdomen after he's trying to punch out. Rock gets a swinging neckbreaker off the ropes, but then he runs into a Triple H knee to the stomach. So eventually, yeah. Then Triple H makes the odd decision to go to the top rope, which even the announcers kind of – Lawler is like, no good can come of this. What are you doing, buddy? You know? Yeah. And Rock punches him. They fight on the top a little bit, and then Rock gets the superplex. Mm-hmm. The ref does the double count here, but Ross covers it, saying that it's just instinctive despite it being a no DQ match. One of the times that he emphasizes the no DQ match. I can recall Ross over the years doing that at least four or five times in different matches where the refs do that. So the refs seem to make that mistake fairly often.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jim Ross is he's a master storyteller himself. And as much as I enjoyed Cole's little heel turn and his little bit there for a little while, it kind of got tired and kind of got really, like, not grating in that good way, but, like, seriously grating. Like, I want to mute the TV now after a while. And, I mean, I'm sure he'll still be doing that. And he's toned it down since the Kiss My Foot match and everything. But, man, I got to be honest. I was so happy to see Jim Ross come back to commentary on Monday.
Oh, yeah.
So happy. Jim Ross is, I mean, he is really, you know, one of, if not the best straight commentary men, you know, in the history of professional wrestling, you know, along with Gordon Sully and Gorilla Monsoon. And he always is aware. And I mean, I guess it's possible that he's being yelled at in his headset, but given the propensity with which he does it and the degree to which other commentators don't do it, I'm going to go ahead and assume that it's got a lot to do with him. That when something like that happens, he's very quick to cover it. And Gorilla Monsoon always was too. Gorilla Monsoon is always right there to explain or try to explain, you know, why a ref might do something or why something was happening. If our logic, you know, if it was something that put our suspension of disbelief in peril, you know, Monsoon and Ross are two guys that I count on to always be right there and be like, no, this is why he's doing that. This is why that's happening. So,
yeah,
keep your suspension of disbelief. And I love them both for that as commentary men.
Absolutely. That's a very good point. I forgot what I was going to say. So,
I'm sorry. You were talking about Jim. They go superplex and they go to the eight count.
Yes.
And that's where Jim Ross was covering them, and that's where I went off in that direction. So wherever you're going from the superplex.
It doesn't matter now. Stephanie tries to here's what it was. As far as Ross coming back, one thing about the Cole thing, and another aside, but let's go ahead and do it. Like, I feel like it's like – when the commentators like bicker at each other so much, and I think this was kind of part of the reason why Cole was so grating at a certain point, it's like you're watching 2 hours of like two people fighting, you know, and no one wants to see that or hear that. I mean, a little bit of it here and there is okay. I mean, obviously even the great commentary, you know, Heenan and Monsoon would get at it every once in a while, you know, Jesse and Vince, but you know, you didn't hear them arguing over and over again for the entire time, or else people would have just gotten so sick of that. And I kind of felt like they just SmackDown in particular, for whatever reason, mm-hmm. they just love to just pit them against each other so much. And I guess they think people are interested in that, or they just like that tension. But it never, I mean, it works in very, very, very small doses, but it does not work as often as they do it.
No, I agree. And it got to the point, again, before the Kiss My Foot match, which I feel like that angle should have really ended probably 2 months before it did, with Cole being really, really, really like in the coal mine and all that, you know, stuff, and being just really antagonistic. It affected my suspension of disbelief as a viewer again. And I know I've used that phrase like 17 times, but you know, it's important. And I think wrestling fans go the extra mile for that. You know, I really go that way to get there for wrestling in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially if you watch MMA, which I'm not a huge, huge MMA fan, but I do watch some MMA. And you, when you're watching, you know, pro wrestling is supposed to be essentially a dramatization of what MMA is. And so you put that suspension of disbelief out there. And we got to the point where I was like, there's no way that any other sport would allow their commentators to behave like this during a broadcast and have one of them not get fired.
Yeah.
You know, you would never hear, you know, you wouldn't hear Joe Buck arguing, you know, with Troy Aikman during a football game. Like, you know what I mean? Like, the NFL would not stand for that. And, you know, you wouldn't hear Larry Merchant and Jim Lampley bickering like that during a boxing, you know, HBO wouldn't allow that. So it gets to the point where you're like, this is ridiculous. Like, there's no way these two should be allowed to carry on like this. And it's happening every week, and it's annoying, and it's, I mean, I say it's unprofessional. I mean, I get that it's a performance, but, like,
sure.
Again, it's to the point where any legitimate, you know, any quote unquote real sport or whatever would never allow this. And it's getting to the point where it affects my ability to believe the show because it's gone so far.
Yeah.
That you sound like a married couple at the commentary table, and it's making me insane. And mm-hmm. I know that nobody else would let their commentators get away with this. So why are you doing it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it'd be one thing if it were like something that was really working. You can be like, well, okay, I don't entirely believe that they would allow this. Like, I mean, we have angles where wrestlers are allowed to beat each other up for minutes and minutes, or, you know, like a heel beat down, like in a real sport, obviously they would, you know, fine or suspend people for doing that, but wrestling they allow. I mean, that stuff,
right?
You know, we sort of suspend, but it doesn't work. Yeah. I mean, clearly, you know, everyone just gets, frustrated like we do. It seems like, you know, with that, I don't really know who finds it entertaining other than maybe Vince McMahon, I guess.
I guess. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know any single person who, you know, by the time that Kiss My Foot match came around earlier this year, I don't know anybody who is still like, this is a great angle.
Yeah.
Like, nobody.
Right. And I did think that the parts of it still at that point, like, were good, but I was even, and I was more into that feud than most people were. Mm-hmm. But even by that point, I was like, well, you know, it's gone. It's stretched its limit. Like, I feel like they did like twice the number of angles they needed to, right, for that whole feud as well. I think, I feel like if they'd done half of them, that would have been more effective. But anyway,
yeah. And for the record, I agree with you that there were parts of it like the actual Kiss My Foot match was great because it was finally Cole getting his comeuppance in a way that everybody wanted to see it. I just would have liked to see it a month or two earlier in the same fashion.
Sure. I see that.
Yeah.
So we cut backstage, interestingly enough, to Steph trying to convince Kurt, who is on the stretcher still, to come back in and help Triple H. Mm-hmm. And he very meekly says, "Only for you, Steph." And then they cut back into the ring, and Rock gets a belly-to-belly suplex for two. Nice-looking belly-to-belly suplex, which it didn't actually look good. In fact, it looks terrible later in the match, but when he does another one. But so Steph eventually sort of drags Angle back in, who is looking pretty loopy and reluctant at that point, but he trips Rock as he's coming off the ropes. Triple H hits the pedigree on Rock, but Angle drags him out and throws him into the steps. Angle tries to take advantage and get the cover, but then Rock kicks out. At this point is befuddled. And what were we going to say?
Yeah, she's looking very confused.
Yes.
I just sort of want to comment on the whole segment you just kind of laid out there. Sure. Before I start forgetting. So the backstage segment that blew my mind. Like, first of all, that they would go live to a guy who actually does have a concussion.
Yes.
Hoping that he delivers the correct line.
Yes.
And second of all, that they, not even that they went like, you know, when they do the replays, like that they would go like, you know, double image style. You know what I mean? They actually just cut from the match completely to a backstage segment.
Right.
That's not necessary at all.
Right.
Like, it would be enough for us to see Stephanie and Angle come out, and we would know she must have convinced him to come out. You know, if she was dragging him by the wrist and he was looking all goofy, we would know without having to see that segment. So that was just weird, I thought.
Yeah.
When he does the pedigree, when Hunter gives the pedigree, you can see he actually looks behind him to make sure Angle is there to pull him off of the rock, because he doesn't know how Angle is, you know, what he's aware of and what his capacity is at that point.
Sure.
So, and then, yeah, as you said, he pulls him off. And then there's another thing very shortly after that. I'll let you get back to sort of giving us the blow-by-blow, but very shortly after that, there's another bit where Hunter very clearly tells Hebner to go tell Angle what the next spot is and make sure he's in position. Cause again, he's not really sure of where he's at.
Yeah. Yeah. then after the kick out by Rock, Angle stomps him in the chest, hits a reverse elbow for two, and which prompts, I believe, Ross to say that Angle is running on love, which is one of my favorite commentary lines from this match, and I think I'm going to have to use that in my real life, that somebody is running on love.
Yep.
Angle hits a very crisp looking belly to belly for two, so either that's instinctual or he's going in and out in any case. Mm-hmm. The announcers point out that Stephanie is not really helping Triple H out on the side. And then Lawler, I think, just says that she's in shock. So Lawler's sort of defending Steph here, and Ross is obviously against her. Then Rock gets on offense, hits a very, very bad belly-to-belly throw mm-hmm. that he did. That was, not so good. Follows it with a DDT, which I wouldn't want to take that in that situation if I have a concussion. Yeah. So we have Triple H eventually heads to the apron, which is probably where you're talking about. They do a reverse Irish whip and Angle's thrown right into him. Rock hits the Rock Bottom on Angle, but then Triple H pulls Rock out of the ring, tosses him into the post. He tells Steph to give him the hammer again. Steph tosses it sort of in the middle of the ring, which Triple H and Angle kind of fight over it a little bit. And Then Steph is behind Angle, and Triple H punches and ends up accidentally hitting Steph.
Yeah, and that's one of the yes, that is the part I was talking about. After the Rock Bottom, there's the whole thing where Hunter drags Rock out, and then he talks to Hebner and like calls him back for a second. It's like, no, make sure he's over there.
Okay.
But when he punches Stephanie, that was one of the biggest pops of the whole night.
Yes.
Only bested by the people's elbow, which gets the biggest, like by far the biggest pop of even bigger than, all the, Jeff Hardy jumping off of tall things, as is his wont. And, Shane McMahon falling off the thing, like the people's elbow, which is such a goofy move. Like, it's not even, what is it? It's an elbow drop. And not even like a Macho Man Savage elbow drop. It's just an elbow drop. But it was over, huge, and it gets the biggest pop of the night. But second only to that is Triple H punching Stephanie in the face.
Yes, yes.
The crowd goes nuts when he does that.
Yes. People did not like Stephanie McMahon.
No.
No.
Did not.
So Angle ends up nailing Triple H with the sledgehammer. And then Rock punches out Angle, sends him over the top rope. And another thing I would not take with a concussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Rock and then lands as the aforementioned people's elbow and gets a three count and gets the big win. So Kurt, then we see him trying to revive Stephanie, then carrying her out of the ring. And we basically fade to black at that point, I believe. So,
yep. So Rock, like, it's weird, though. It's a weird dynamic. Like, Triple H is selling the people's elbow like grim death. So he's laying just, he's like a still life painting.
More the sledgehammer. People's elbow, but yes.
But, I think a lot of times what the people see last is what they retain. What I mean? They don't always think, and I could be wrong about that, but it seems to me like if the audience saw, the last thing they saw was the people's elbow and the Rock pin him, then I think a lot of times people think it's because of the people's elbow or, whatever the combination of offense he's selling as much as the internet would have us believe that Triple H never puts anybody over. He's laying there again, like a still life painting, and Rock is celebrating, but he's not celebrating in the ring like he normally does. He goes to the entryway and he gets up on some of those, that metal scaffolding type stuff. And he does his normal, that way he flips the belt back, that only the Rock can flip a title belt back that way.
Yeah.
And he celebrates and the crowd's cheering him. And then, so, essentially what we've done is we've set up a couple of different scenes that the audience can sort of take them in all at once and they don't interfere with each other, which is, again, smart on the part of either whoever booked that or the performers themselves having the wherewithal to know we need to be here and here. Mm-hmm. So that nothing we do interferes with anything the other guy's doing.
Sure.
So Kurt is able to take Stephanie and play that out while Rock is celebrating on the thing and doing his thing, and everybody's able to see that and all be happy. And Kurt takes Stephanie away, And I, for the life of me, don't remember what happened after that. I really don't.
Okay.
Refresh my memory. I'll probably remember once you start talking about it.
Sure. Well, we had, I believe the next pay-per-view was Unforgiven. Mm-hmm. And we had the first Kurt Angle and Triple H singles match. And they basically, the feeling was, okay, Stephanie's going to turn on Triple H here, go with Angle, then they're going to have Triple H chase forever and get his revenge, and then maybe you could even go to, like, WrestleMania, just because, you know, it just seemed like that was the natural way that they were going to go. Instead, Triple H beats Angle pretty much cleanly, and then they have, like, this really awkward, bloody kiss between Triple H and Steph. And so sort of he takes his woman. And that basically ends that story after basically just one more month of it. Now, Angle ends up at the next pay-per-view beating Rock for the title and sort of becoming a – I don't know. He sort of has, like, a – 5 month reign as champion, and but sort of is always like, you know, like almost like the Honky Tonk Man kind of thing.
Yeah, I was going to say that actually.
Going by the skin of his teeth, which is weird because, like, this has always kind of been a weird thing with Angle, where I don't, and maybe one reason why I never felt like Angle quite joined like the very very top club, like he was always like at the top of the next tier, where. Obviously, Angle had the credibility to be – obviously, he was an Olympian, incredible wrestler, you know, could beat anyone, you know, in real life kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But because he had that kind of that goofy charisma and had that kind of like funny sort of deluded type character, sort of like a Honky Tonk Man. I mean, a little bit less cartoonish, but in that same vein, they booked him – as if he was that clown, as opposed to booking him as that. I mean, now later they would have periods where they would kind of book him as the monster, but by then it was kind of too late because his personality had already kind of been established as the goofy guy, and he was the kind of the guy who wins by the skin of his teeth, and you know, and you know, I mean, he cheats, but he doesn't cheat like in like a Mr. Perfect kind of way. Like he cheats in like more of a Honky Tonk Man kind of way.
Yeah, I think to me, it wasn't until probably three or four years later that he really got over as like probably going into going into what WrestleMania he had matches with Benoit, two WrestleManias, or maybe it was a Royal Rumble.
It was Royal Rumble 03, I think is what you're talking about.
Yeah, where it was really, they finally built the story around, like, these two guys are, you know, pure wrestlers, and they're going to have a scientific classic. And I think that was about the time where I really started to be, like, where Angle really started to get over with me as something besides a jester. But I definitely remember feeling like, you know, again, I was 17 at this time, and I probably fancied myself a smark to a certain degree.
Sure.
This is when I was... I posted on the lordsofpain.net message boards and you know that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I didn't. He just didn't get over with me. I never bought him in his first title reign. I never bought him as champion. I didn't stop watching the shows. It takes a lot to get me to stop watching the shows. I never bought him as champion, and I was chomping at the bit for him to lose the title, but not in the way that I was chomping at the that fans, you know, and were chomping at the bit for The Miz to lose the title. Mm-hmm. More in the way that I was like, I don't buy this guy as the champion. I don't like him as the champion. He's, and like you said, it's like a Honky Tonk Man thing. And that worked great for the Intercontinental Championship, you know, and I wish someone would do that now with the Intercontinental Championship, because maybe it would get a little bit of airtime on TV if someone was doing that with the Intercontinental Championship now, or airtime that anybody cared about or paid attention to, I guess I should probably say, because I feel like whoever the Intercontinental Champion is, they're usually on TV, but I never remember who they are.
Yeah.
I know Ziggler's the U.S. champion. I honestly don't know who the Intercontinental Champion is right now.
I think it's Ezekiel.
Is it still? Okay.
I think so.
That works good for a sort of a secondary type title, but I think with the world title, you can't get away with that, especially at the time when, weird as it might sound, there was only one world title in WWF at the time. And so Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I never bought him. I never put him in that top tier with, you know, there was a six-way on my 18th birthday at the December pay-per-view, Armageddon, I think it was, or whatever they called it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I felt like pretty much any of those guys except for, I think Rikishi somehow was involved in that for some reason. But I think I felt like four of those guys were, you know, on that top tier, and Angle and Rikishi were kind of like, well, we don't really have anything else to do with them, so put him in this match, like, you know, and I was like, all right, you know, and that so I agree with you there. I never really bought Angle until years later as, you know, the real deal.
It was just kind of weird. The contrast between those things. And for some people, like Tom Holzerman, for instance, he's a really huge fan of how they did that with Angle. But for me, I just didn't. I mean, I always admired Angle as a performer, and I think he just, I mean, obviously he was basically a rookie at this point still, and I guess he had a couple years in their training, the developmental system, but, you know, he was not very far in, and he progressed amazingly well, and he had some very good matches and stuff. But yeah, it just didn't seem to click that well as champion, although he didn't. Like they hurt business or anything like that. I mean, they were doing great at this point, especially at pay-per-view. Actually, although, you know, we talked about kind of the peak being 99, which I think is true for the TV ratings. But as far as the money and the pay-per-view were going, that the peak was actually 2000-2001, which is kind of interesting when they re-emphasized the wrestling. That was kind of part of what happened. I mean, there are probably other factors as well, but they were able to create more stars and, you know, all sorts of things, but
I mean, you know, Val Venus getting his wiener fake chopped off doesn't sell pay-per-views. You know what I mean?
That's true, right?
You know, it gets people to watch TV, but it doesn't sell pay-per-views. Wrestling sells pay-per-views because as much as WWE is kind of deluded by this notion, apparently for some reason, people don't buy WrestleMania to watch the Miller Lite catfight girls in a pillow fight. That's not why people watch WrestleMania. They watch it for, you know, Undertaker Shawn Michaels or you know, whatever, right? So
it's the wrestling and it's also the story fulfillment. I mean, you know, you're building to a great story, but sorry to didn't interrupt, but
no absolutely. But I think, you know, so I agree, and I don't know, I've never been one really to pay super close attention to the ratings. And even when I was watching Raw and it wasn't doing as well as Nitro, and I only watched like the first hour of Nitro because I was always a WWF guy at heart, I never really paid attention to like who beat who in the ratings, like unless Eric Bischoff was calling my attention to it. I didn't care, and I don't pay attention to pay-per-view buys, and I don't, you know what I mean, I just don't. That doesn't really interest me, but I have no doubt that you're right, and that's the case. And I mean, it must have been because 2000, 2001 is when, you know, this is the period where WWE went from one of the big three to the big one, you know? And ECW, I think there were external factors, and I think, I mean, WCW just straight up got steamrolled by Vince is ultimately kind of what happened there. And they had some problems internally, and they eventually sold to Vince for much cheaper, interestingly enough, than he originally offered them.
Yeah.
You know, and so this is that time. So they must have been making money, and pay-per-view is probably their biggest, I would imagine, their biggest hands-down moneymaker. Because for, you know, wrestling, as far as ad revenue goes, still gets a lot less for airtime, you know, for ad time in prime time than pretty much anything else does.
Yeah.
Which continues to blow my mind. But, you know, I guess we're second class citizens as wrestling fans, I guess. So advertising to us shouldn't be as valuable.
Well, we don't have the best demographics either, you know. And some of us smell, so that's part of
the problem. Well, yeah, but, you know, I might smell, but I still buy stuff.
Yeah, maybe not deodorant, but...
Well, right, yeah, no, but whatever, dude. I still buy Skittles and Castrol GTX.
Well, there you go. That's a good point, yeah.
You're doing something right.
All right, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the wrestling was fantastic on these pay-per-views. And I just want to say a word about SummerSlam, actually, since you're doing this whole project. So one of my best friends was over here and we watched the show together. We got some pizza and we kind of made a thing out of like, hey, I'm going to watch some old wrestling. Oh, great. I love old wrestling. I'll come over and watch it with you. And so my roommate and myself and one of our very good friends, we watched it together. And, you know, we were talking about how, you know, as much as I love WrestleMania and the aura of WrestleMania, and, you know, I've had like 14 consecutive WrestleMania parties at my house, wherever I'm living, even though I don't order any of the other pay-per-views because I watch them at bars where they're showing for free. You know, I still always order WrestleMania, have people over for WrestleMania. But really, you know, if I'm being honest, I think SummerSlam is the best, generally speaking, the best wrestling show of the year. Because it's not bogged down with Liberace and Miller Lite Catfight Girls and that kind of stuff. So while WrestleMania usually probably has the best match or, you know, one or two matches, I always find that SummerSlam is a more solid show from top to bottom.
Yeah,
I always feel.
I think you're mostly right, and particularly the main events I've found. I've watched nearly all of them now, and there are, other than one or two, most of them are really good and really fun, and most of them are superior to the WrestleMania main event of the same year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, even when they're not great. So, I mean, like you guys talked about the Rude Warrior cage match, right? Like, that match isn't great when you compare it to especially a lot of Rick Rude's other work.
Mm-hmm.
But that might be, you know, the second or maybe even best match that Warrior ever had. I don't particularly care for the Macho Man retirement match. I don't like it. A lot of people do. I know you do.
Oh, I love it. Yes.
I can't get over the fact that he kicks out of like six elbow drops. That drives me nuts every time. And I just like, it taints my whole view of the rest of the match. And I think it's kind of boring besides, if I'm being honest. But either way, even if you like that match, which I know you do, you got to say that that Warrior-Rude cage match is one of Warrior's, you know, it's right up there with that match and with his match with Hogan at WrestleMania 6 is probably one of the three best matches Warrior ever had.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it's not, you know, it's probably not better than the WrestleMania main event from that year, which I think, you know, I think the Hogan-Warrior match, for as much as it's, again, not a scientific classic, told a really great story, especially with two good guys, and with Hogan finally dropping the title, you know, but it's a really great match for Warrior, and it really stands out among his oeuvre, if you will, you know, and so even for that, it's great, even if it's not a great, great match on its own merits.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it is a... you know, yeah, SummerSlam really is always a strong show. Royal Rumble, too. Yeah, I think Royal Rumble would be up there as far as if you're talking about kind of best wrestling show of the year. I think the Rumble obviously has a lot to do with that because there's only one or two Rumbles that aren't, you know, pretty good, at least pretty good. So,
yeah.
I would agree that, you know, particularly when it comes to the main events, really, SummerSlam has delivered almost every time. And really, since the mid-90s, there's really not a bad one there. You know, a few that are just okay or good. But they are pretty – they're generally pretty outstanding. So It is kind of nice to – you know, it's still an important show, but it's not like a pressure show, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. I've always felt like it's the second biggest show of the year in terms of, and I guess I don't know if that's the official, you know, company line or what, but I've always felt like SummerSlam is second only to WrestleMania in terms of, you know, this is the big show that we gotta, you know, that we gotta deliver on, and it always feels special to me, especially since I live somewhere where it's cold and miserable for a lot of the year, and so I don't know. I guess I just have a lot of fond memories associated with watching SummerSlam, with, you know, the windows open or cooking out or doing whatever, and so it's a big show in the summer, and you know I really enjoy it for that. So.
It's the biggest party of the summer.
Yeah, it's the biggest party of the summer. And, you know, the funny thing is Mike Adamley referred to it as Summerfest at one point, which is also a big thing for me because Summerfest is the world's largest annual music festival that takes place on Milwaukee's lakefront every year. So when Mike Adamley talked about going to Summerfest, I was like, wait, what? There's going to be wrestling at Summerfest? I was like, oh, he's just dumb.
Yes.
There's
I live in Columbus, Ohio, and there's a Summerfest here as well, so...
There you go.
It's one of the best radio station in town has a Summerfest. They even have a Summerfest Eve this year because there are so many people for Summerfest. So,
nice.
Yeah.
Let's see. There you go. Maybe we'll see Mike Adamley at these events.
I can only hope. I can only hope. Good old Mike Adamley.
That's right.
Well, anything else you want to touch on as far as the match or the time period goes?
Let me see. I'm just trying to think. I mean, again, it's kind of a weird thing for me. I to watch the whole show, for the first time, I mean, I have the SummerSlam box set, but I think this is the first time I've watched this whole show from start to finish since it aired.
Okay.
All those years ago. So, again, I was really surprised at how solid of a show it was and how many of the matches were really, like, even Road Dogg versus X-Pac, which I don't remember that angle at all, really. Okay. I vaguely remember eventually, didn't they feud over the rights to DX or something weird like that?
At one point? Yeah, I think that was right about this time.
Yeah,
I kind of tuned most of that out. I mean, I remember this was the death knell of DX, of course, up until the the 06. Yeah, so it was not a high point for that stable, that's for sure.
No, but even that match is reasonably solid, and I like Pac, and I'm not going to say I always have, because that's probably a lie, but I like Pac. I think he's very underrated, and I think he doesn't get enough credit for the heat he gets, and people are always like, oh, no, it's not good heat, but I think it is. I think Sean Waltman knows exactly how to get the right kind of heat, and if he wanted to be cheered, he would get cheered. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a great match, and I don't really care for Jesse James at all.
No.
Especially when he's not in a tag team, because I think tag team wrestling is a unique art to just wrestling in general. Mm-hmm. And I think Billy Gunn and Jesse James were extremely good at tag team wrestling, but I think as singles wrestlers, they're both pretty terrible. But even that match, which I'd say is, barring the completely insane thong stink face match, is the low point of the show, and it was still a pretty good match, even being the low point of the show.
Which, by the way, that was a WrestleMania rematch, the thong stink face match. So
yeah, that's, and you know, hey, it was a scientific classic at WrestleMania, so you know, why not go back to the well for that one?
Sure.
I just couldn't believe that was even happening, like, in front of my very eyes. I was like, is this seriously? That's what they're doing? That's what this is? It's which girl can put her butt in the other girl's face first.
It would fit in today. There's a lot of ass-based offense in WWE women's matches over the last month for whatever reason. A lot of shaking, a lot of sticking in the corner, a lot of things going on. So I'm not sure what it's about, but it's interesting.
That's true. But they're trying to, they're staying at that PG level. So I think ladies in thongs rubbing their nearly bare asses in each other's faces.
Probably not.
That probably would boost the show to a PG-13 or, you know, whatever.
I would guess so. Yeah. So
I think that's pretty much all. I think I'm pretty well tapped out at this point. It was a great show. I would recommend anybody who has access to it. Again, I have the SummerSlam box set because I'm a nerd like that. But go back and take a look at this one, because it was really, really surprised me, especially in comparison to 98 and 99, which have some bright spots. But you're kind of like, man, the wrestling wasn't that great in 1998 and 1999, despite what my memory tells me about how good wrestling was at that time. Actually, this is a very well done show, except for I have some quibbles about the Benoit Jericho match, about being a 2 out of 3 falls match that lasts 14 minutes, which,
right,
why bother having a 2 out of 3 falls match at that point? But other than that, it's really good, as you would expect from those two guys. So
yeah,
really good card, top to bottom. I recommend it.
Cool. Yeah. So why don't you let everybody know about, plug anything you want, and let them know what you do.
Oh man, let them know what I do. Okay. So I'm sure they're probably, as you mentioned at the top of the show, I am a contributor to Fair to Flair Quarterly. So that's a thing that everybody should check out. Although if you're listening to this podcast, I have difficulty imagining that you haven't checked it out yet. And of course, the reason that I'm such a well-worn podcaster is because if you go to onthestick.com, I'm a co-founder of onthestick.com, and we do a generally bi-weekly video game podcast, but at this point we're doing pretty much weekly because we've had so many guests and so many reasons to do things. So if you like video games and you're sick of everybody on the internet talking about how much they hate everything and you want to hear a little bit of positivity and lots of penis jokes, come over to onthestick.com and check out our podcasts. There's actually one from WrestleMania time. We did a special for WrestleMania that actually has nothing to do with video games. We just talk about every single WrestleMania for like 3 hours. So if that sounds interesting to you, you can check that episode out. There's the full archive is at the site. I also am on another podcast known as The Action Cast, which is at onthestick.com/actioncast, where we talk about action movies. And again, for wrestling fans, WrestleMania week, we watch The Scorpion King and No Holds Barred on The Action Cast. So if you want a double feature of awful, go to onthestick.com/actioncast, or you can find these are both these podcasts are on iTunes. And that's pretty much it. That and as I said, I do Fair to Flair with you guys. I contribute to the magazine, but not the website, just the magazine. So you have to pay money if you want to read what I write.
Yeah, exactly.
So
and you're on Twitter, of course, as well.
Oh, yes, of course. And I am on Twitter @shake_well. And you can also follow @onthestick and @actioncast if you want to follow those podcasts as well. We'd love to have you in our little community. So
cool. Well, everyone, of course, check all that out. And you can, of course, go to WrestleSpective.com and FairToFlare.com for all the wrestling you could ever hope for and love and so forth. And a lot, and of course, we're going to keep continuing this podcast series, counting down main events of SummerSlam up until the day of the show. So keep checking out our shows. And thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Let's be honest. Most wrestling websites suck. BS rumors, schoolyard gossip, plagiarism. It's no wonder why no one believes anything they read on the internet. Well, if you can't get something done right, you might as well do it yourself. Presenting the Fair to Flair Quarterly from the writers of FairToFlair.com and over a dozen other wrestling websites. We're not copy and pasting what we read in some newsletter. This is 100% original content from the best wrestling bloggers on the internet. In-depth analysis of the art of pro wrestling, debate, artwork, and humor. The Fair to Flair Quarterly will raise the bar of what wrestling journalism can and should be. Professionally edited and produced, and every contributor will be paid for their work. Order your copy of the Fair to Flair Quarterly today at FairToFlair.com. The better wrestling media has arrived.